given conjunctive normal form is valid. So I've heard that you already have the solution, so maybe you just want to explain it. Maybe in front. Yep. Actually, we should maybe...
The question from the lecture before the last one was, how hard it is to determine if a conjunctive normal form is valid? So a conjunctive normal form is a conjunction of clauses, so a conjunctive normal form is valid if all the clauses of that conjunctive normal form are valid. And a clause is valid, but a clause is a distinction of literals or negated literals, and a clause is valid if it contains at least one literal in negated form and a non-negated form. If it contains one literal in negated and non-negated form, it's valid. So all you have to do to determine if a conjunctive normal form is valid, check all the clauses. If they are valid, and to check all the clauses, you just have to skip over all literals and determine do they occur unnegated and negated. And if you found one, you can stop. And if you exhausted all the space, you know it's not valid. And so how hard is it? It's the number of clauses in the conjunctive normal form times the number of literals in the clauses, maybe literals of the clauses squared, depends on how you would implement the check, if a literal occurs negated or non-negated.
Thanks. How many of you were in complexity of algorithms? Used to be basic lecture. Okay, that's enough. So basically, we've heard an argument that this is doable in polynomial time. Can we do better? Was that a stab at an answer, or I didn't catch you? Logarithmic space in fact suffices. Why? Yeah.
So you have to store indices of the current variable you're looking for, and then compare.
Right. So basically, as a reminder to those, or reminder, well, as a bit of additional complexity theory for those who haven't been in complexity of algorithms. There is a fairly important complexity class called L. I mean, the short name sort of gives away how important it is. Of problems solvable in logarithmic space. So actually in less space than the input, right? Of course, that can only work if you don't actually count the space where you store the input in your overall space consumption. So this is in a Turing machine model with two tapes. So this here is the input tape. And this here is the work tape, so the input resides on the input tape, which, to be fair, is read-only, so you cannot cheat and actually write into your input and clandestinely, you know, remember things by overwriting your input. And the space counted is only the one on the work tape. So logarithmic space is the class of problems that can be solved by only logarithmic space overhead, is the term to make this clear. I mean, overhead. Beyond the space that your original input consumes. It is fairly clear that L is contained in P, so that the class and any problem that can be solved in logarithmic space can also be solved in polynomial time. In fact, you can use the same algorithm, right? So the algorithm that does it in logarithmic space will also run in polynomial time. Why is that? Well, A an algorithm that has that uses space log n, or O of log n, will have at most 2 to the O log n many different states that it can take, that it can attain, right? So there's only 2 to the log n, so which is basically n, or well, 2 of, to the O of log n different states that your work tape can have, if I'm assuming some fixed alphabet, so it's the size of the alphabet to your to the power of your space consumption. And then, of course, okay, there's an additional factor that comes from the fact that your program or your Turing machine, the control unit of your Turing machine, has a fixed number of states. But that's just another constant that enters. So there's at most 2 to the O log n states of the machine, counting the machine, the control unit, and the work tape. And of course, we expect these algorithms to be terminating, right? Otherwise, they don't count. So we want algorithms that terminate on every input.
What's the definition of an algorithm?
Depends. No, there can be algorithms that don't terminate. But, I mean, it depends on how you define an algorithm, really. But I mean, in some for some computation models, you don't demand that they terminate. So, for instance, a non-deterministic program can diverge. I mean, that just counts as a negative answer, basically. So, and because they terminate, of course, they cannot enter any state twice, because as soon as they do that, they're in a loop and they won't terminate. So this is at the same time then the estimate of the runtime. And of course, 2 to the O log n is polynomial. So L is a class that is under P. As usual, that's all we know. So we don't know that it's properly under P, so we don't have a separating problem that would be solvable in P, but not in logarithmic space. But of course, everybody believes that L is properly under P. In terms of what can I do in logarithmic space in terms of programming, well, essentially what I can do is I can do anything as long as I use only pointers into my program. Into my input. So I can a logarithmic space program is essentially one that uses only a fixed number of pointers into the input. Right. And the algorithm for deciding validity of CNFs that we've just heard does just that, right? So let's say we have a CNF made up out of three clauses that are somehow stored on our input tape. In the shape of some literals that are maybe listed just one after the other. What do I have to do? Well, I go through all the clauses with my pointers and determine for each clause that it's valid, and as soon as one is not valid, I stop. And to determine whether, say, this clause here, the first one, is valid, well, I have one pointer that searches for, say, a positive literal that I just let go through the entire clause, and I have a second pointer that searches for the negative literal, and as soon as they find a match between a positive and a negative literal, we're done. And that's really all we do. Okay, so we, depending on how the literals are represented, we maybe need a third pointer to actually establish that the A, which may be, for instance, some lengthy string or so, is the same in both cases, so that's maybe a not one, but two further pointers into the input that I need, but it's clear that we can do this using only pointers. We don't ever have to read substantial portions of the input into memory. Okay, so that's in logarithmic space, hence much easier than polynomial time and massively easier than the general satisfiability problem. And in fact, as hard as evaluating a propositional formula under a given valuation. So, for instance, yeah, so. So this question here, given some valuation, does it satisfy a given formula? So this is a bit, the notation is a bit cavalier, of course, but you knew what I mean, right? So deciding whether a given valuation satisfies a given formula, it can be done in logarithmic space. That is actually non-trivial. As I've already mentioned that Nancy Lynch, 82 maybe, or even in the 70s, not sure, maybe in the 70s. So that's non-trivial to do because Boolean expressions have a bracketing structure, right? So you think that you would need to remember bracketing depth somewhere, right? Well, actually you can do that in logarithmic space, of course, because the bracketing, if you just need to remember bracketing depth, you can actually do it because that's a logarithmically large number. It's a linearly large number which you can represent in logarithmic space. But it's more complicated than that. So it's a fairly complicated algorithm, but it works. Okay, so if that's so easy, testing whether a conjunctive normal form is valid. Same, of course, goes for disjunctive normal forms and then satisfiability, right? Everything's dual. So checking whether a disjunctive normal form is satisfiable can also be done in logarithmic space. So how about this algorithm to check whether a given propositional formula is valid? So my perfect propositional prover. Convert it into a conjunctive normal form and check that that conjunctive normal form is valid. I mean, that sounds like a terribly efficient procedure, doesn't it?
Can you what? Terribly
big? Right, thanks. So I get exponential blow up on the way, right? So the reason for this is basically this rule here. How did we form the conjunctive normal form? Well, which way around was it? Was like this, right? If we had an occurrence of and or that were the wrong way around, we applied distributivity. So we transformed it into this term here. And the downside of this is that the chi gets copied. So where we've previously had one copy of chi, we now have two. And that produces the exponential blow up. So no, it doesn't magically prove p equals np. It's not really an efficient procedure to determine validity of a propositional formula. Okay. That much for our little intermediate problem from last week. So let's remember where we are. We were looking at the sequent calculus for propositional logic, so we had, I'll just recall the rules actually. So this was the left rule for conjunction, right, to prove that something follows from a conjunction, just take it apart into its two disjuncts. Then the right rule, which had two premises, that require that in the same context A and B are both consequences of gamma in the context delta, then thank you all the time, yes. I will get this right at some point during the course. No need to mention, of course, that I went into Gloin yesterday and started using small letters for propositional atoms. Okay, and then the same for negation. So the left rule to conclude that something follows from not phi, we just equivalently demand that phi itself follows from the same context, and right rule to derive not phi in some context, we just move it to the left and derive something from it. Okay. And of course, there's the axiom rule. Now, really, just for a propositional atom, we've discussed this. So if there's the same propositional atom on both sides of the turnstile, then we have an axiom, so we just write it down without having any premise. Okay, and we had already proved soundness, and we were in the process of proving completeness. And I'll say again what that is. Completeness was the claim that whenever a sequent is valid, then it is derivable in that system. And the proof was more or less by cases, and the first case that we had dealt with was this one. That was, so it was the case where no rule would apply to the sequent. And we were able to see immediately that, well, not immediately, but it was fairly easy to construct a valuation that disproved the validity of the sequent in that case. Okay, so this was done, right? So we have the second case where some rule applies to our sequent. Well, of course, going backward, right? Our sequent is the conclusion of some rule. And in this case, we use induction. And we do it stupidly. We just use induction on the size of that thing. And basically, we do a case distinction again. Namely, well, we know that some rules applies to the some rule applies to the thing, and we just do a case distinction over which rule. Well, we only have so and so many. Okay, let's start with this left rule here. So if the left rule applies, so it looks like this. actually this is the same. So then gamma has this form here, right? So it contains some conjunction. And we could derive it from the sequent on top. I forgot to mention the whole thing is under contraposition, so we're assuming that the sequent is not derivable, and we're showing that it's not valid, right? So I think I made that explicit yesterday. So because this sequent isn't derivable, this sequent isn't derivable, because if this were derivable, then we could, by means of this rule, derive this one. So that's not derivable, and well, the commas don't count, right? I haven't exactly said what my size measure is, but I'm just counting the sum of the size of the formulas. I'm not counting the commas, and it's so properly smaller than the previous one because it's missing one symbol. So by size, I mean total number of logical connectors. So maybe let's make that explicit. Okay, because it's smaller, I can apply induction. So by the induction hypothesis, the sequent on top here, gamma prime and phi and psi imply delta, is not valid because it's not derivable. Well, but this sequent down here, in terms of validity, is immediately equivalent to this one here, right? If I translate them into a logical formula, in fact, the logical formula that I get out is the same one in both cases, because I just reintroduce that conjunction here that I gave up here. So this implies that my original sequent is also not valid. Yeah, let's do one more of that kind. Evidently, right, the two rules for not just both work exactly the same way, because in both cases, the formula into which I translate the premise is immediately equivalent to the formula into which I translate the conclusion. So the only one that's slightly different is the one for conjunction on the right. So in this case, my sequent has this shape here, where phi and psi comma delta prime is my original delta. And I conclude that from two premises, namely that, or according to the rule, I could conclude it from two premises at once, namely that, first of all, that gamma implies phi or delta prime, and gamma implies psi or delta prime. Okay, now I know that this thing down here isn't provable, so these here, these are not both derivable. If they were both derivable, then I could derive the sequent on the bottom, about which I have assumed that it cannot be derived. So of course, which one of these it is, it doesn't really matter, right? In both cases, the proof proceeds in an entirely symmetric way. So I'll just fix as the case that we look at, the case where the left one isn't derivable. So again, of course, this sequent here is smaller than the one at the bottom. It's missing, well, not only the whole of psi, but also this conjunction here. So by the inductive hypothesis, I can conclude that this is not valid. And now in this case, the conclusion here, if I translate it into a formula, recall the gamma becomes a big conjunction, the entails becomes an implication, and the commas on the right become a big disjunction. So if this is already not valid, then this is even less valid because I change one disjunct by demanding even more, namely psi. So this implies immediately that this sequence here, my conclusion, is not valid. Okay, so like I said, these two are very, very similar. In fact, similar to the first one. And this one here remains. And this one's just impossible, because I'm assuming that my sequence is not derivable. If the axiom rule were applicable to it, then it would be derivable. But I've said it's not. So the rule that is applicable to it in this case here is not the axiom rule. And that was actually the full completeness proof. I mean, there's, okay, now it took up like more or less, I mean, discounting that thing here, one part of the blackboard, and we used up, I think, half a part last time, so that was one hell of an easy completeness proof. What one should keep in mind is, in particular, if one wonders why this proof is actually so much easier than the one that was previously seen in Gloin, by maybe not everyone here, but some of you, well, that proof actually also proved more. Here, we basically prove completeness only for, well, single sequence, which in terms of expressivity are the same as single formulas. So basically, this is about the same as saying every formula that is valid can be derived. What we proved in Gloin is the same for this kind of relation here, where we had an infinite set of assumptions. So we allowed ourselves an infinite set of assumptions from which we were drawing logical conclusions. So this here says every valuation that satisfies all formulas in capital phi will also satisfy psi. And this is related to a notion of derivability that basically allows me to use as many assumptions from phi as I wish in a proof. Of course, these can only be finitely many because the proof is finite, but I'm given my whole pick of assumptions from this infinite set of assumptions. And this, of course, is one or two levels harder, right? Because I have to deal with this infinite set of formulas. And effectively, when I turn this into a satisfiability proof, I basically have to prove that whenever a set of formulas, possibly infinite set of formulas, is satisfiable, then I can build a model for it, which is, yeah, like I said, clearly harder. Okay, so this finishes our proof of completeness for the system. And now, actually, what we want to do today is rather tutorial. So I want to do two things today. The first thing that I want to do is I want to show how this can be used. I mean, so this is a calculus that is there for proving that things are valid. the first point I want to get across today is that this is a calculus of a form that will also allow us to establish that things are not valid. Basically, because it allows for a terminating proof search. And if the proof search fails, then we can be sure that because we've shown completeness, if the proof search fails, meaning there is no proof, then we know that the sequent is not valid. So let's think of some formula that fails to be valid. Like what? Okay, here I just, I hope that's not the one that I put into the exercises. Is it? Do you have the exercises open? I think that example, I think, had three literals, right? Of three different atoms, so it's different. So, okay, so we can use this one. The exercise uses capital letters. Yeah, well, I think you'll all get over it. Maybe I'll replace it tomorrow. Right, so this here is a formula that, as we all know, is not valid. So it is perfectly possible for two atoms to imply each other. I mean, what are the possibilities for that? So what valuations would falsify this formula? Well, actually, if you can't tell now, I mean, it will come out in the end, so let's just do it. Okay, so there's one task involved here. We need to get rid of the logical connectives that we've only defined rather than put as basic connectives in our system, because I don't want to waste time on a trivial task like that. I'm just going to do it for you. So this translates into... Why doesn't anybody correct me? Okay, of course you can't see it if I write it the wrong way around. I mean it this way, of course. Okay, so like this, right? I need to close the bracket, yes. So this hopefully would be the translation of this, right? So I translate A implies B into not A and not B. Okay, this is already slightly shortened compared to the translation that would actually come out by first translating it into disjunction and then translating out the disjunction. So there's a slight simplification that applies by removing double negation. So that's already in here. And this here, it translates in, so this inner formula translates into this, and so this formula here says that these cannot both happen at the same time, so it states that not the conjunction of these two things. Yeah, okay, so that's a correct translation. So now you could start the sequent calculus on this and see what happens. indeed wanted to do that, yes. Parentheses aren't matched, no. Wait a moment, this one is just too many, basically, yeah. Sind nur irgendwie, wenn man über die Kartoffeln diskutiert, ne, die falschen Sachen unterstrichen. Ne?
Unterstrichen?
Du hast das nicht unterstrichen. Ach so, das ist nicht unterstrichen. Das ist, es ist so rum. Ach so, es ist einfach ein Regelstrich. Okay, ich sehe schon. Das ist keine Unterstreichung. Alles klar. Yeah, this looks a bit right. So you maybe want to show us. Can you write on the board? Thanks. Oh, the chalk is there, maybe.
Okay.
There's some copying error along the way. Right. So from the third line down, down from the top. It should be on the right. No, one line down. So there, the right hand one should be B and not A. The right hand one of the two. So that one should be B and not A. So the B, the not in front of the B should go that one. Yeah. And then if you follow it going up, then it should again be B and not A, right. Yeah, in principle, this shows already that proof search fails, right? Because when we branch, this is in a sequence calculus, we're looking for proofs. This is conjunctive branching, right? So if we have two premises to a rule, we have to prove both of them. And now you've traced this back to one premise, which is seen top left, turnstile A, B. That is not provable. I mean, we're not going to be able to prove that A or B holds. So, and in fact, we can read a falsifying valuation of that sequent, namely. Yes, but if we make both of them false, then we make that sequent false, right? So, and that gives us also a valuation that violates our original goal. So, which is clear. I mean, the formula was constructed in such a way that it says, well, it's not possible that A and B are equivalent, but so imply each other. And of course, that's bogus, right? So it is perfectly possible for A and B to be equivalent. For instance, they can both be false. We can also find the other possibility in the proof tree if we pursue it further, right? So there's a second valuation that will do the job, which we find elsewhere, right? Yeah, so this is a slight abbreviation, but yes. So, and this we falsify by making A and B both true, right? So, basically, so the complete proof tree, if we do the proof search completely, I mean, stupidly, of course, I mean, we already know that the proof search fails, but we carry on nevertheless, right, hoping to get some stuff in the other branches. But basically, the failing branches give us satisfying valuations for our formula, so, which is clear, right? All the leaves to which we at which we arrive, all the leaves would have to be true in order for valid, basically, would have to be valid in order for the conclusion to be valid. So as soon as we find a leaf where we find which we can falsify using a given valuation, then that valuation will also falsify the original goal. So not only does this procedure basically allow us to decide whether the formula is valid, if we do it completely, then it will also give us all falsifying valuations. Well, up to okay, the leaves may of course. On occasion, not mention all the variables, right? That could happen. I mean, it doesn't in this case, but in general, it could happen that there's a leaf up in the tree that doesn't mention all the propositional atoms that occur in the formula, and then of course it gives us the valuation only up to a part that doesn't matter because it doesn't actually occur there. Okay, so that was the one thing that I wanted to do today. Of course, in preparation for a rather similar exercise on the sheet. Yeah, this can go. Okay, so a Okay, let us start a few steps back. If any of you did happen to look at the already mentioned Wikipedia article on the sequent calculus, which, by the way, I have actually corrected yesterday. I don't know if that correction survived. Then you will find that the calculus listed there actually has two categories of rules. Logical rules, which are like the ones that we've seen, although not quite the same, only like them. And so-called structural rules, which don't appear in our calculus at all. So one of these structural rules, for instance, would be the weakening rule, which, of course, again comes in two versions, left and right. So let's look at the left one. The rule is this. If I have shown that gamma entails delta, then gamma and some additional garbage that I assume will still entail delta. It's clear that this is sound, right? I mean, clearly by just introducing more assumptions, I will not destroy any conclusions that I've already drawn. Well, actually, when you look for logics hard enough, you will find logics that don't satisfy this rule, where additional assumptions will actually invalidate inferences. That's called non-monotonicity. But here, I mean, in good old classical propositional logic, that is clearly not going to happen. So if I make more assumptions, then my proofs are still going to work, obviously. Maybe all the easier, or maybe at least as easily as they did before. And the same goes on the other side. So if I've proved that gamma entails delta, then gamma entails also a comma delta. This looks slightly surprising because things appear to the right of the turnstile, so why should I be able to derive a? But remember that this comma here is disjunction, so this here reads a or something in delta, and of course, since I can already derive something in delta, adding a as an additional alternative does not destroy the validity of the sequent. So these rules, you will, and similar ones, such as the one that you're asked to deal with on the sheet, don't explicitly appear in the version that appears in the Wikipedia article, but we have omitted them. And the reason we have omitted them is that we don't actually need them. And now there can be a lot of confusion about what it means for a rule to be quote-unquote superfluous. And there's two versions of that. So let's say I have sequence S1 up to Sn in a premise and a conclusion S0, so that's also a sequent. So all this together gives me a sequent rule. And I can demand that such a rule is derivable. Well, derivable means that there exists a proof of my conclusion S0, which is some tree that ends in the sequence S1 up to Sn. So basically, if I assume sequence S1 up to Sn, then I can conduct a proof applying my rules that ends in S0. And one of the exercises on the sheet asks you to derive or actually develop and derive certain rules, namely the ones for our new connectives implies and OR. But, and of course, if a rule is derivable, that I don't have to include it in the system explicitly, because instead of applying the rule, I can just carry out the proof that I developed in order to derive the rule. I can just insert that in the proof instead of the rule itself. Rules can be superfluous in a different way, and that is called, say the rule is called R, and we say that R is admissible if adding R to the system, so to speak, doesn't help, in the sense that it does not make sequence derivable that weren't derivable before. And of course, this sounds like R is actually useless, right? So why would we want to add it? But of course, it's clearly a property of R that we want, because, I mean, we have already determined the semantics of a rule system. We know which sequence we want to derive, namely the valid ones, and if some rule would suddenly derive additional sequence, then it would, just by dint of our completeness proof, it would then derive sequence that aren't valid, which is clearly not what we want. So if we want to add any rules, then they should certainly be admissible. And so these rules, left and right weakening, they are not derivable. I'm not going to be able to produce any sort of proof of this here that from just this assumption. You can play around with it. I invite you to actually try it. It's quite instructive. You will not manage to prove this. Nevertheless, it is true that these rules are admissible. So adding them to the system does not prove more sequence. And yeah, we'll just do that. So I'm wondering. A is, as usual, I was intending to use A as a placeholder for an arbitrary formula, so just, so. Okay, so the question is, how does one prove this? And, let's first of all see what it is that we actually have to prove, right? So, we assume that some sequence is derivable, as I'm saying, under weakening. So in the system that includes our rules that were there before and our two new weakening rules. So if that is the case, then we have to show that the sequent is also derivable without weakening. And so once we've shown that, the rule is admissible. That is, we cannot prove more sequence than we could before. All the ones that we can prove were provable anyway. Okay, now there's two ways of doing that. And I'll illustrate the cheap way on a slightly more complicated rule. So the cheap way is this. We have the cut rule. And the cut rule says the following. So actually, this should be, there's two cut rules, I guess. The cut rule says that Is there really two? Well, maybe there's only one. So let's say we have this rule here, these assumptions here. We can derive from gamma 1, delta 1, or phi. And then we can derive from gamma 2, or phi, delta 2. Well, the rule tells us we can chain this together matching phi. So this says we can derive this thing here. If you've been to Gloin, how many of you, or Glolab, or how many of you have seen the basic logic lecture? So this rule is basically the resolution rule that you see in the resolution calculus in the logic lecture. Recall that these basically are positive formulas and these are negative. So I'm matching a positive formula with a negative and then just forming the union of the rest, destroying the matched formula in the process. If you want to think about why this is sound, then just move the deltas to the left and the gammas to the right, right? So if I move the delta 1 to the left, negating it, right, then something implies phi, and phi implies something wherein I move the gamma 2 to the right. So of course I can chain these two implications and then move gamma 2, gamma 2 and delta 1 back to where they came from, and out comes this here. So this just basically says I can chain implications. Okay, so this rule also isn't in the system. This rule, by the way, is what the system is all about. Or more precisely, the fact that it's not in the system. So why is this rule bad? From the point of view of a computer, primarily. No, it's even worse than that. Yeah, I have to compare the phi on the one hand and the phi on the other hand. Yeah, it's worse than that. It's
but there are very many different permutations or ways to split that.
There are many ways to split that, but in the end, finitely many. Okay, yes, right.
You can pretty much get any phi from that.
Right. Keep in mind. So what we just did was apply the rules backwards, right? So we start with some goal and then expand backwards. So if we start with this goal and we want to apply this rule here, well, all of a sudden we have to invent the phi. And for instance, if we want to decide whether this thing is provable, so we want to conduct exhaustive proof search like we just did, this is going to kill us completely, right? So this can be any formula whatsoever, however large. This can be a billion symbols. Right, and we don't know which ones of these we have to take into account and which ones we don't. So this is a rule that we most definitely want to get rid of, and that was one of the insights of Gensen in the system. And basically, actually, he did include the rule in the system, and then he proved in a very elaborate way that we can get rid of it. So basically, if we have a proof that uses this rule, then we can produce a different proof through a lengthy normalization procedure that will actually get rid of rule applications of this kind. It's called cut elimination. But given where we stand now, it's actually completely easy to show that this thing here, so cut L was wrong, so it's just the cut rule. That this rule is admissible. How do I see it's admissible? Well, we're looking at this thing here. So we just derived it using this rule, and we have to prove that it was derivable anyway. Well, So, like I said, this comes from cut. Well, cut is clearly sound. I've just argued that cut is sound, and it's easy to come up with a more formal proof that will actually show you that cut is a sound rule. Well, if I just prove this using a sound rule system, then that means that the sequence is actually valid. Well, if it's valid, then it was also derivable by the completeness proof. So, okay, so there's apparently a way that involves cheating, right? So once we know that our system is sound and complete, any sound rule is clearly admissible. Okay, so that is not necessarily what we want. We want to use this as an exercise to illustrate how we can show that a rule is admissible without resorting to semantic completeness. Because, for instance, there are some calculi for which we don't have a complete semantics. And then if we don't have that, then arguments like this are just not available, basically. The other thing is, quite often we take the object that a proof constitutes serious as an object. In particular, when we look at intuitionistic proofs, for instance, we'll go for the so-called programs are proofs paradigms, or the other way around, proofs are programs, whichever way you like. And if I take the proof serious to a degree that I regard it as a program, then not only do I want to know that a program that's equivalent to the one that I'm given exists, that basically doesn't use some mechanisms like the equivalence of the cut rule, I also want to know how to get it. So this original Gensenstein proof normalization, which tells us how to transform a proof that uses a given structural rule into one that doesn't, is of importance in itself. So now we're going to do that for the case of the weakening rules. For the cut rule, one can also do it in principle. It's fairly complicated, so we're going to stay away from it. Okay, now, this, however, proving that the weakening rule is admissible is actually fairly easy. So, we're assuming that this thing here is derivable under weakening. And we have to show that it's derivable also without weakening. So I'm claiming that we can assume without loss of generality that the weakening rule was actually the last rule that that was used to derive this sequence here. Why? Well, if it wasn't the last rule, basically we go back to the last occurrences of the rule in the proof, just show the same claim for the sequence that we find there, and once we've shown that those are all derivable without weakening, then we have this rest of the proof that leads to our target sequence here without using weakening. So we can assume that the weakening rule was the last rule that was used in our proof of this sequence here in the system with weakening. So we have two cases. depending on which of the two weakening rules were used. Actually, I'm speculating currently that I have to deal with both of them at once in one induction. So I really am doing a case distinction, and I have to do the second case, I think. Okay, so the proof looks like this, right? This here is gamma, which decomposes into gamma prime in some formula phi that I've just added, and I've derived this from gamma comma delta. Okay. Now, not comma, turnstile. And gamma prime, of course. Okay. So basically, roll all this back. So this is not a good way to say this. I'm going to say it differently. Forget it. Sorry. So the better way to say this is we're going to prove admissibility of these rules by showing that the derivable sequence are closed under these two rules, which will then imply that adding the rules to the system doesn't prove more stuff because, basically, when the first time we apply it, we get something that was already provable before, and the second time again, etc. Whatever we do in terms of applying these rules, we will always produce sequence that were derivable anyway. Okay, so now, we take a derivable sequence. And we have to show that the conclusions of my two weakening rules are, again, derivable, of course, without weakening. So we show that both the results of left weakening and the conclusion of right weakening are derivable. And now this is by a slightly new technique. It's by induction over, well, actually we've already done it for the soundness proof, but there it was sort of very implicit. We do this by induction over the derivation of my original sequence here, gamma entails delta. And essentially that means a big case distinction over rules, but now we really have to take our induction more seriously and basically say, okay, whatever proof tree we have above our rules, we can again apply our inductive hypothesis to. So we do a case distinction over the last rule that we applied to prove gamma entails delta. So now I'm going to do one of them. Sort of arbitrary, I guess. Which one do I pick? So let's say I pick the left AND rule. So this means that gamma is of the form gamma prime, comma, phi, and psi. Delta remains the same, and I proved this from a sequence that looks almost the same, except that I took apart the conjunction into a comma. Okay. Phi isn't very good here, of course, because I've already used phi, so let's make that chi. So chi instead of phi. Okay, because my derivation ends in the application of this rule, that means that, of course, that this here, this premise, was derivable. Well, then the inductive hypothesis applies. Which means that adding some junk formula like phi to this will still be derivable. And now I can apply my left conjunction rule to this sequent and obtain that this sequent here, where I again turn the comma into a conjunction, is derivable, which is what I had to show, because this here equals gamma comma phi, recalling that I said in the beginning that sequence are, we don't care about the order of formulas in a sequence. Okay, so that was that step, right? And now we have like 14 minutes left. Would ask you to do the remaining cases. So this time I don't want everybody brooding over their own sheet, but we're just going to pick a volunteer to go to the blackboard, and well, he's just going to be the guy writing, and you tell him how to do it. So being the volunteer might actually be the better job, because you, like I said, you don't have to think it up yourself. You will just take dictation. Ah, right. Yeah, before you all run away, we should maybe clear that. Yeah. Has everybody formed groups? Anybody not in a group? There's one person, there's three persons, not four persons, not in a group. Perfect. That makes two groups. Okay, that's solved. Very good. So, we need a volunteer. Like I said, the volunteer's got the easy job. Okay, the gentleman in the striped sweater wins the the lottery. Okay, I think we still have to wipe, so yeah, this. While the board gets wiped, the other ones can already think what to tell the guy. Oh, no, don't wipe that, only the this one. Not the rules, ideally, maybe the thing on top there. All right, pretend I'm not there. I could, if you insist, physically leave the room. Don't look at me.
If xm x was the 5-4, we have gamma prime, comma a, term file a, comma delta prime.
What was
a?
A.
Term file. A, delta prime. That's the variable, and so we can just add another phi on the left or right side, and that's still derivable using x.
Okay. Anything to write?
Implies gamma. Prime, comma a, comma phi. Term file a, comma delta prime divisible.
So this case was actually more confusing than the others because it's non-inductive, right? We don't need the inductive hypothesis here, right? I mean, it's just also the implication is true but not really necessary, right? I mean, this just is derivable, right? Because it still has A on both sides. I mean, it has nothing to do with whether or not the other thing is derivable. Yeah? So maybe somebody wants to do a one of the inductive cases. Those are actually easier to understand, I think. I think the phi should actually be a chi according to the dictation, so that's one of these funny cross things. Yeah. And gamma comma phi term style phi comma delta prime is derivable too. So now using and drive we know that gamma comma phi term file chi and psi comma delta prime is the graph. Any takers for the negation rules? I mean, of course, it suffices to one of them, right? I mean, they are very symmetric. Right? Okay, it's probably best if we leave you guys to mull this over until next Monday, so we can briefly finish this next Monday. So let's briefly look in our heads, because I don't have the projection screen down. Look at the sheet. So the sheet consists of four exercises. The first one just asks you to do derivations. No, wait, the first one asks you to derive some rules, right? So we've got our abbreviated connectives, OR and implies, and you should think up left and right rules for them. Of course, you also find these rules in the standard sources if you want to, and then prove them. And they're actually meant to be derivable, so you can actually derive their conclusions from the premises once you've done the translation, obviously, of the defined symbols into the basic symbols. Then you're asked to do actual proofs in the new system. Well, basically, for formulas that use the defined connectives, but of course then using, among other things, the rules for the new connectives that you've proved in the first one. I guess that should be doable. Then there's a proof search exercise where you're asked to do a complete proof search on a formula that fails to be valid, so proof search fails. The idea is really that you do the complete proof tree and not stop as soon as you find one unprovable leaf, with the goal of actually identifying all the valuations that invalidate the proof goal. And then there's the meta-theoretical bit where you're asked to prove admissibility of another structural rule, namely the contraction rule, that allows you to take two copies of an assumption or conclusion and turn it into one, which basically says it's not all that important that these things are multisets. We can just as easily make them sets. It's just technically more convenient to have them as multisets. And the proof will run a very similar course as the one on weakening that we're doing currently. So I really want to finish this proof here on Monday. So if you'd all give it some thought over the weekend, that would be good. Thank you very much.